It comes just days after Vice President Kamala Harris discouraged would-be Central American migrants attempting to escape poverty, violence, and extreme weather, factors that are inseparable from decades of U.S. intervention in the region, including the promotion of neoliberal policies and genocidal right-wing dictatorships from fleeing to the U.S. Researchers at Amnesty analyzed the Biden administration's approach to six components of the immigration system: immigration detention, access to asylum at the border, unaccompanied children, climate displacement, refugee protection, and temporary protected status. Most alarmingly, the administration needs to immediately reverse its direction on immigration detention, where it is rapidly going backwards, and fully restore access to asylum at the U.S. southern border, where it continues to maintain the Trump administration's policy of blocking and expelling people at the border. Failure to act and course correct is a betrayal to people seeking safety. Emphasizing that the drastic rise in the number of detained people reflects how the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, is reverting back to a blanket use of detention for people arriving at the border, the report notes that shortly after President Biden took office, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, reported detaining 13,860 people on February 5th. As of June 18th, the number of people ICE reported detaining has skyrocketed 82% to 25,238. His proposed budget for fiscal year 2022 funds detention space for 32,500 beds. Returning to Obama administration levels of detention is not progress. It is history repeating itself. In addition, the report points out the Biden administration has shamefully continued the Trump administration's policy of misusing the Title 42 Public Health Authority to block and expel people at the border recklessly, endangering lives. There is no public health rationale to treat immigrants and asylum seekers differently, and it is causing irreparable harm to them, the authors wrote. The welcoming of unaccompanied children at the border while continuing the expulsion of families and individuals has created family separation. The report states, between March 2020 and May 2021, the government summarily expelled nearly 875,000 people, particularly affecting black immigrants and asylum seekers. The Biden administration has expelled over 400,000 of those people. This misuse of Title 42 continues despite objections by CDC officials and against the recommendations of public health experts. All of this was entirely unnecessary and violates U.S. obligations to uphold the right to seek asylum and not forcibly return individuals to a place where they would be at risk of serious human rights harm. According to Amnesty, recent statements suggest the Biden administration will continue to rely on mass detention for people arriving at the border, particularly when it ceases to misapply the Title 42 public health quarantine to block access to safety at the border. The report notes, the Biden administration must act much faster to move children from these emergency intake sites and close them down altogether. Emergency care is not suitable for the long term. It is a stopgap measure for discrete, short periods. In addition, the report notes the Biden administration continues to misuse the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act to immediately return almost all unaccompanied Mexican children to Mexico. CBP is failing to adequately consider the protection needs of Mexican children by forcibly returning them and belaying the administration's commitment to welcome children seeking safety. The human rights organization also calls on the Biden administration to more robustly grant humanitarian protection through Temporary Protected Status, TPS, to protect people already in the U.S. from forced return to their countries of origin because of ongoing armed conflict, extraordinary and temporary conditions, and environmental disasters. Nearly half a year in, the administration has still not delivered on change that has not only been promised, but is of the utmost urgency. Dennis Bell, researcher for refugee and migrant rights at Amnesty International USA, said in a statement, "There is no excuse that can get the United States government out of its human rights obligations. While systematic reform that respects human rights means explicitly addressing the racism underlying the U.S. immigration system," authors of the report wrote, "current policies that perpetuate deterrence, detention, and deportation do the opposite and must be eliminated to end the systematic harms against black and brown communities." For each of the six immigration policy arenas examined in the report, Amnesty made specific recommendations. Some of the group's proposed solutions include immediately stop expelling individuals and families under Title 42, end the use of arbitrary mass detention, and incorporate a presumption of liberty in custody determinations, with asylum seekers and immigrants allowed to live in the community. Supported by sponsors and community-based programs operated by nonprofits to assist individuals in navigating the immigration process. Release people held in immigration detention through an affirmative file review process with a presumption of liberty, prioritizing people who are most at risk of harm in custody, including families and children, HIV plus individuals, pregnant women, and those at heightened risk of contracting COVID-19. Phase out IC contracts with private prison companies and county jails. End family detention and close all three family detention centers. Continue to urgently address conditions at emergency intake sites and raise the standard of care to meet children's best interest, while implementing changes to safely release them faster from such sites, and communicating a transparent plan to stop their use altogether and ensure that unaccompanied Mexican children are given fair and meaningful access to asylum, as all unaccompanied children and people seeking safety should be and not turned back, with summary and inadequate considerations of their protection needs.
Around the World with Reporters.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey, before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless acts there in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his whole household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be, at least to be honest in all our believing, to submit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
The 10th day of Muharram has been a day of mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein ibn Ali, also in Italy. Faithfuls from across the Italian peninsula met at Rome's Imam Mahdi Islamic Center to honor the Battle of Karbala and remember the sacrifices of the Imam Hussein, whose death is considered a symbol of the struggle against tyranny and injustice.
I have goosebumps when Ashura comes, and I move to tears when I listen to Imam Hussein's words. I always take my children to the Ashura ceremonies. I want them to understand what Imam Hussein did for us.
Ashura is everything to me. Ashura is death, rebirth, life. We have to follow Imam Hussein's example, the way he stood against his enemies, who were nothing but traitors.
The Ashura commemoration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center has been attended by Shia Muslims coming from a number of countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, India, and Moldavia.
Many at the Imam Mahdi Center here in Rome believe Ashura is not just a day in history. They are of the idea that Iran's consistency in resisting hegemony is rooted precisely in the culture of Ashura.
Our resistance to hegemonic plans is great thanks to the legacy of Imam Hussein. Active opposition to hegemony is possible through resistance at the level of everyday life. In fact, our faith reflects a model that can serve all societies.
Celebration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center have included performing tajiyeh, cooking various kinds of food and distributing it among the attendants, and a final speech by Sheikh Abbas de Palma, in which he remembered the Battle of Karbala and the attack and the killing of Imam Hussein, Max Civili, Rome.
The video was filmed on Ashura Day inside the Sukaina Shrine in Daraya in Damascus countryside before the war in Syria started. Mourners used to peacefully mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, the site nowadays is in a totally different situation. Terrorists occupied and used the shrine as a stronghold during the clashes that happened there, gradually causing its destruction.
Terrorists are implementing a global and intelligence plot. They target our symbols and try to destroy them. For example, in Raqqa, they destroyed the shrine of a symbol of Siffin battle, Sayyid Ammar bin Yasser, and in Damascus, Sayyida Sukaina. They want to break the morale of resistance supporters.
Those images are seen by Syrians as an interpretation of what the followers of oppressors and tyrants of our time want for Islam, which are terrorists operating as tools of our time's main oppressor, the United States. In 2016, they left Daraya to Idlib, leaving total destruction behind. But their departure reflected their ultimate defeat. It was resistance by the Syrian army and its allies that led to their victory.
Islamic resistance all around the world raised the flag of righteousness and defeated Takfiri terrorism, Israel and the U.S. The resistance in Lebanon and Syria derived its power from Imam Hussein's revolution in Ashura, which created the philosophy of freedom and liberation.
Sayyida Sukaina is the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the sister of Imam Hussein, who led a historic and peaceful uprising against the tyrant Yazid. He was martyred in 680 AD along with his companions, while his family members were brutally taken as captives from one city to another. Syria is a country that hosts a large number of holy Islamic sites. Takfiri terrorists' Islamic disguise was eventually unveiled, and the truth was revealed that they are just agents of the West. If it wasn't for the resistance movement and fighters who follow the path of Imam Hussein, probably many other sites, like Sayyida Zainab Shrine, would have been destroyed. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees who have just crossed into Iran, a country they call it a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak crossing point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil. something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 under pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now, with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
Twenty-four hours after the first plane carrying Italian nationals and diplomatic staff arrived in Rome from Kabul, top officials from Italy's government expressed their opinions about the Afghan crisis. Prime Minister Mario Draghi stressed the importance of preventing terrorism from spreading and protecting Afghan civilians and those who worked with the international community. Separately, the head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Luigi Di Maio, called on Western countries to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the U.S.-led occupation that went on in the landlocked Central Asian country for 20 years. Analysts and commentators have also been deeply critical of Washington and its allies.
Betrayal, that's all Afghans are left with. All of their expectations have been betrayed. The ethical failure comes even before the political one. After 10 years, the U.S. had finally killed bin Laden in 2011. Why did they stay in Afghanistan? To export democracy? In the interest of whom?
About 50,000 Italian soldiers were deployed to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, making Italy one of the countries most involved in the region, along with the United States, Turkey, Britain, and Germany.
It was on December 30, 2001, when the Italian military arrived in the area entrusted to them by the U.S., the quadrant of Herat, in the northwest of Afghanistan. The number of Italian soldiers killed since the beginning of the U.S. occupation is 53.
Also, about 700 Italian soldiers have remained seriously or permanently injured. The mistakes made by the U.S. in Afghanistan include handing government posts to sycophants or corrupt figures.
Italians were puzzled after U.S. President Joe Biden's recent statements in which he admitted that the reason for staying in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's killing was not to rebuild the country, but to prevent other terrorist threats from arising there.
I have been very much disappointed by what both Biden and Blinken said about the drawdown. Biden's shift from nation building to limited counter-terrorist strikes in Afghanistan is very hypocritical. Many of us were there to rebuild a ravaged country. I hope European members will finally work towards creating a European Union military force. It's the only way we can have our say on international issues.
Italy's foreign ministry has said it is now working on a coordinated international initiative in Afghanistan to ensure humanitarian flights and make sure to tackle the emergency in an organized manner. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah, in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Harabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussein slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last 3 decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Sedri Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, you know, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Pariza, London.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, after calling the scenes in Kabul bitter, dramatic and terrifying, announced she would look for ways to secure possibilities for refugees in the neighbourhood of Afghanistan, that is, somewhere that is not inside Europe. We now present you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times and Miami Herald, and an ex-researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Afghan Refugee Crisis Headed for Europe. Unsettling images of thousands of Afghans storming Kabul airport to force their way onto planes out of the country put European officials on notice that a refugee crisis was looming. That suggests that, like US President Joe Biden, they had no notion that a quick and complete Taliban takeover of Afghanistan was likely, and what that might mean. First, those involved in NATO's two-decade intervention in Afghanistan, along with other European Union countries, are focused on getting their own citizens and Afghan collaborators out of the country. That exodus is underway. But in European capitals, officials also quickly turned to another paramount concern: how to avert a flow of tens of thousands of desperate refugees to their borders and avoid the political fallout that might arise from uncontrolled immigration. European Union ministers are scheduled to meet on the subject in the coming days. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, after calling the scenes in Kabul bitter, dramatic and terrifying, announced she would look for ways to secure possibilities for refugees in the neighbourhood of Afghanistan, that is, somewhere that is not inside Europe. French President Emmanuel Macron warned that Europeans must protect ourselves against major irregular migratory flows. The cold attitude reflects an anti-migration turn in Europe spanning 6 years. Gone is the so-called grand gesture of Angela Merkel's 2015 invitation for refugees, mostly from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan, to come to Europe. 1 million crossed Greece and the Balkans and into Germany. But Germany's difficulties in absorbing the newcomers, plus Angela Merkel's demand that other European nations also take them in, created a surge of opposition to immigration. The upswell led to several anti-establishment electoral victories. Notably, Brexit referendum campaigners exploited Germany's open-door policy to whip up immigration fears. Thank you. the welcome mat is being pulled in recent days as the Taliban closed in on Kabul. Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, Austria, Belgium and Greece asked the European Commission they be allowed to continue deportations of Afghans already in Europe, but whose asylum requests have been denied. With the Afghan government out and the Taliban insurgents in, the question is moot for now. Angela Merkel is not repeating her blanket invitation. France is demanding the European Union decide together. The United Kingdom said only it will design a selective, bespoke approach to accepting asylum seekers. The leaders of Italy's two most popular parties, both nationalists, said the country should let in none. Hungary and Bulgaria announced they will not accept refugees. Leventa Magyar, the Hungary's deputy foreign minister, said Budapest would not pay for the flawed geopolitical decision of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. The election calendars of the European Union's two leading countries, Germany and France, explained their reticence. German national elections, in which Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union say the U-Party is trying to maintain its dominant position in parliament, are set for next month. Merkel is not running. Emmanuel Macron faces a stiff challenge from nationalist rival Marine Le Pen in next year's French presidential vote. Scenes on Sunday, 15th of August, of hundreds of Afghans cramming into a U.S. military cargo plane and the sight of a pair of men falling from the sky after losing their grip on landing gear added urgency to European worries. But crisis possibilities were building long before. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, since January, about 400,000 Afghan civilians have been displaced by combat. There were about 250,000 of them since May, when fighting picked up, and 2 weeks after Joe Biden announced Americans' pullout of Afghanistan. Austria is already deploying its army to its eastern border to block migrants. Greece started to build a fence along its land border and install noisemaking technology to deter refugees. And Hungary's president, Viktor Orban, built a similar barrier in 2015. He was vilified as a racist. No one's raising a ruckus now. Meanwhile, Turkey, a non-EU country but a major way stop on the land route to Europe, is making it clear it does not want to host Afghan migrants seeking asylum elsewhere. It has played that role during Syria's long war and hosts more than 3 million refugees, most of them from Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rejected American and German proposals that asylum seekers wait there while their petitions are being processed. Turkey is building a concrete wall along its border with Iran, through which Afghans are passing from the east. In recent weeks, 27,000 Afghans crossed Turkey's border on their way to Europe, presidential spokesman Fahrettin Altun declared. Turkey does not and will not serve as any country's waiting room. We will continue to do everything in our power to preserve the safety of our borders. Since 2015, more than 550,000 Afghan refugees have sought asylum in the European Union. They are the second biggest group of asylum seekers after Syrians. In the past 5 years, the European Union quietly moved to seal its eastern frontiers with fences, while drones routinely scan the borders. The chances of getting asylum vary from country to country. According to the Washington Post, positive recognition of Afghan asylum claims range from a high of 94% in Italy to only 4% in Bulgaria. Germany accepted 44% of requests, while Belgium accepted 32%. Outside the European Union, besides Turkey, Iran and Pakistan host more than 3 million refugees each. Pakistan says it will permit Afghans access to refugee camps near the border, but only temporarily. Iran is setting up refugee camps on the border and is accepting newcomers warmly and requesting them to return home when Afghanistan calms down. Besides the chaos at Kabul airport, television news and the internet have been full of Afghan worries of coming repression under the Taliban. The warnings come mostly from people who benefited from the so-called nation-building efforts of the United States and Europeans in Afghanistan. Teachers, professionals, government workers, and especially women, but they're not on the list of those who worked for NATO forces or non-governmental organizations, NGOs. They will not gain easy access abroad as the airlift from Kabul ramps up. Will those left behind face the repression under Taliban rule that characterized their previous 1996 to 2001 reign in the country? That period included oppression of women, prohibitions on educating girls, as well as punishment of men who resisted strict religious practices imposed by the Taliban. Sports and music were banned in Afghanistan. Beards and religious chanting were required. But the possibility of those days returning is not much on the minds of Europeans right now. Controlling migration is.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, the Kufan mentality. The people of Kufa, that is, those who, after receiving the news of the death of Muawiyah the oppressor, gathered in the house of Suleiman ibn Surah de Khudai, delivered speeches, took into consideration the position of the Muslims at that time, and wrote a letter to Imam from that very place. And similarly, those who visited Muslim, the representative of Imam, after his arrival in Kufa and took oath of allegiance to him in his capacity of the special representative of the Imam of the time, did not in fact intend to tell lies and deceive their Imam and to provide means for his martyrdom and the captivity of the members of his family. Truly speaking, their intentions were quite good at that time. They deemed the caliphate of a person like Yazid, and that too after 50 years of the death of the Holy Prophet, to be shameful and inadmissible for the world of Islam, and did not consider anyone among all the Muslims to be more competent and more deserving than Hussein ibn Ali, the son of the Holy Prophet. They thought that they had always rendered him assistance and would continue to do so in all circumstances and would bear all hardships to achieve their divine object. They turned out to be liars and forgot what they had been thinking about themselves earlier. Let's take a short break and draw some lessons from this historical account as we come back.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the Kufan mentality. And we said that the people of Kufa who pledged allegiance at the hands of Muslim wrote the letters to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they were inviting Imam to come and establish truth and justice in the society. They were initially sincere when they were writing those letters and when they were pledging those oath of allegiance. So what happened afterwards is what we're trying to understand. Brothers and sisters, the attitude of the people who really wished that Imam Hussein alayhi salam should come at the helm of affairs and Bani Umayyah should be deprived of the Islamic government underwent such a change that although Muslim bin Aqil was keeping himself aloof and seldom met the people, he was obliged to shift from the house of Mukhtar to that of a well-known and powerful person named Hani ibn Urwa. His supporters used to visit him there secretly. So why in the world would Muslim bin Aqil, the representative of the infallible Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, make this move? Because he did see the disloyalty of some people. Because he did see that even those who are claiming to be our friends and supporters, they are conspiring against us. The conditions in Kufa at the time indicated that all the letters which had been sent to Imam Hussein and the promises made with him were mere lies and could no longer be relied upon. Ibn Ziyad succeeded in locating the place where Muslim was then residing. How did that all happen? It was because of the fear of losing this world that all of those people, they turned against Muslim, or a heavy majority to say the least, because of the fear of losing this world. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence fill the air.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Africa Today.
African countries are deploying troops in Mozambique to combat terrorists in the country's gas-rich Cabo Delgado province, which has witnessed deadly attacks by Takfiri terrorists and rebels. Recent attacks forced global energy giants to stop activities in the region, while locals have borne the brunt of the violence. One of those affected gives an eyewitness account on what happened during an attack by terrorists. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. Now, in the first segment of our program, we are focusing on the decision by several African countries to join in Mozambique's war on Takfiri terrorists. We are asking, what are the chances of success in this mission, and what's the French connection? In the second part of our program, we shall focus on the situation in Nigeria, where children have been forced out of school due to an upsurge in abductions, especially in the northern part of this West African country. A parent of one of the abducted children speaks here during a protest gathering.
We stand in one voice,
we condemn what that has happened, and we'll protest, we'll continue to protest until our children are brought back.
African forces join Mozambique's war on terror. Since 2017, armed militants linked to Takfiri terrorist groups including Daesh have been on the offensive in the northern Mozambique energy-rich province of Cabo Delgado. The human toll of this violence is grave, with more than 3,000 killed, nearly a million displaced, and an acute hunger crisis. With several thousand fighters, the Daesh-affiliated Al-Shabaab in Mozambique has conducted increasingly sophisticated military operations, including by reportedly working with intelligence cells within the Mozambican military. Regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, also known as SADC, and Rwanda are following up on committed troop deployments and training missions. Speaking during a SADC summit in April this year, Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, said the region cannot remain indifferent to the insecurity in Mozambique.
We cannot stay indifferent as our fellow compatriots in a SADC member state continue to wallow under the atrocious, brutal, and indiscriminate assaults meted out on them by these faceless terrorists. For these attacks are a clear affront to the SADC vision of a region that is peaceful, stable, secure, and prosperous.
The Southern African Development Community held an extraordinary summit on June the 23rd and approved the deployment of what is known as the SADC Standby Force in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism in Cabo Delgado. Now, the bloc's executive secretary elaborates here at the end of the one-day summit in Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
Seven summit endorsed the recommendations of the report of the chairperson of the Organ on Policy, Defense and Security Cooperation and approved the mandate for the SADC Standby Force mission to the Republic of Mozambique to be deployed in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism and the acts of violent extremism in Cabo Delgado.
Now, for more analysis on the situation in Mozambique and the deployment of regional forces to combat terrorists, we have contacted Dr. Yusuf Adam, a Mozambican historian and academic. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, first, can you tell us some of the reasons for the current insurgency in Mozambique, which has been going on for several years now?
These areas of Cabo Delgado, etc., are areas which have been have a big problem with youth. They have a youth bulge. The second problem we have to mention is corruption. Corruption is rampant in Mozambique. The problem which we also have to take into consideration is environmental destruction. And the other problem is that the companies which are going to exploit petrol inland and onshore and inland, they have limited certain areas. And these areas are off limits for the local fishermen.
Well, clearly from what Dr. Adam has just said, the insurgency in Cabo Delgado is partly due to grievances by local people who are suffering from neglect by the government and exploitation by global energy giants in the region.
In Cabo Delgado, thousands of people are being forced from their land to make way for gas exploration by Western fossil fuel giants Shell, Eni, ExxonMobil, Total, and others. Instead of locals benefiting from their immense natural resources, they are seeing poverty, conflict, debt, and pollution. What prompted regional African countries to make the drastic decision to send troops to Mozambique years after insurgents started their attacks?
At this moment, the war has been increasing, yes. The Mashababus they had attacked Mocimbo, but then they attacked Palma. And at the moment they attacked Palma, mainly means that they have stopped or they have obliged the French company Total to stop its activities and many other companies which worked for Total. And at that time also there was very big coverage in the press internationally about what was going on in the region.
Rwanda, which is not a member of the Southern African Development Community, was the first African country to deploy troops in Mozambique. Now, sources say SADC was concerned about a non-member country deploying soldiers in the region without its approval and ahead of the bloc's own troops.
Mozambique insists that while it remains committed to working with SADC to restore peace to the northern region, it can partner with other African states to address its security challenges. There have been reports that Rwanda is sending troops to Mozambique to protect massive economic interests of France. However, Rwanda's military spokesman says the deployment follows a request by Maputo.
The purpose of this mission, first of all, is based on a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda to help support in conducting military operations, including the security operations and stabilization, as well as security sector reform. So this was a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda, and this is part of a bilateral agreement that we had since 2018.
Rwanda is the only African country outside the SADC bloc to deploy troops in Mozambique. Rwanda's decision came after Emmanuel Macron's visit to Kigali. Now, is Rwanda probably acting on behalf of France to protect French energy giants engaged in Mozambique LPG projects?
I think that the Rwandese at this moment are some kind of private army. They are all Tutsis. It's a private army. It's a private army which belongs to a state, which is Rwanda, and they are attacking, they are in Mozambique, they came first, and till now there are, the information which we have about their activities are more or less part of the propaganda that they have. I think that basically the Rwandese are going to stay around Afungi and create an area of 25 miles of radius, more or less, around the Afungi, which was the area and the conditions that Total had asked the Mozambican government.
SADC deployment of troops and equipment to Mozambique has been welcomed by many local and international observers. Southern African states had been under pressure to mobilize and help the Mozambican forces to restore security and ensure civilian protection against attacks in Cabo Delgado.
Now, the main argument in favor of a regional intervention is the risk of a violent spillover into Mozambique's neighboring states. However, regional troops face many challenges, chief among them financial resources to fund the troops and experience in battling insurgents. Now, do you think regional forces will eventually restore stability in the restive Cabo Delgado province?
Yes, inshallah. I hope we will manage. And what we have to do at this moment is to combat the root causes of this war, which is having more girls in schools, so we don't have this youth bulge. We have to have the proper participatory development where the population feels that what they need is given back to them, water, sanitation, health, roads, infrastructure, etc. Job creation at a massive scale, so the young people can really feel the benefits of the development.
Well, there you have it. Our guest says the solution to the insurgency in Mozambique is to ensure that the people benefit from the country's resources. But will the insatiable greed by the mainly French energy giants allow the people of Cabo Delgado to benefit from their wealth of this region? Now let's take a short break. And when we come back, we shall focus on school children in Nigeria and how they have been